Surgical Intervention. Baltimore, Timeline 2, May 2020. Federal Employee 00491-0023 Classified Voice Transcript. Dr. Scranton.
I have some bad news for you, gentlemen. We lost another drone to the anomalous timeline yesterday. That's Timeline 178. Situation's escalating.
Liaison, Central Intelligence Agency. Fuck. Colonel Smith.
Lewis, what can you tell us about it?
Liaison, Air Force.
Mission 3 was flown by an RQ-4 Darkstar. It departed from Wright-Patterson AFB at 1620 local time, then headed south until it crossed over water, topped up from an Air Force tanker, and climbed to flight level 700. Once at cruise altitude, it triggered its armband unit to take it to the destination timeline via Timeline 1, and that's all we know. It's more than a day past its minimum fuel reserve time, so we're calling it a definite hull loss.
Colonel Smith.
Wait a minute. If this was Mission 3, what were the first two?
Liaison, Air Force.
We followed the usual protocol for newly opened indirect access timelines. A ground-level atmospheric sample return box to confirm the presence of air and gravity, then mapping using MQ-1 Predators. They fly in daylight at medium altitude with cameras set up to perform a wide-area survey of the eastern seaboard area. They were expecting business as usual, an uninhabited wasteland, or at most, Paleolithic hunter-gatherers. But neither of them came back, and after two hull losses in a row, some bright spark decided to up the ante. The RQ-4 is a high-altitude stealth drone, sort of an unmanned U-2 analog, and it's now overdue, never showed up. Didn't activate its Doomwatch device either.
Dr. Scranton.
Doomwatch?
Liaison, Air Force.
It's a special armband unit, a world-walking machine, with a flight data recorder attached. It's switched on right before the drone transitions to its target timeline and logs all the telemetry from the drone's flight control system and instruments. If the drone does anything unpredictable, Doomwatch ejects and transitions back to the home timeline immediately, then pops a parachute. That way, if there's no breathable atmosphere or the UAV encounters a thunderstorm or some other irrecoverable situation, at least we get an idea of what happened.
Dr. Scranton.
So you got a positive for atmosphere and gravity using the preliminary sample return box, but then lost three drones in a row, the last of them a high-altitude stealth machine. But the Air Force aren't totally stupid.
Colonel Smith.
Thank you.
Liaison, Air Force.
Indeed. So this morning we sent up a sacrificial Tier 1 UAV, a NAT-750, programmed to bounce over to Timeline 1, continue to Timeline 178, buzz around at 500 feet for a while, then phone home. The first three drones were real aircraft, things that need a runway and ground crew. The NAT is a toy with a 10-foot wingspan that you launch off the back of a Jeep. Anyway, it came back bang on schedule. Its meteorology package said conditions over there were fine, too.
Liaison, Central Intelligence Agency.
Shit.
Colonel Smith.
The scatological commentary is getting old, Barney.
Liaison, Central Intelligence Agency.
Sorry. It's been a bad week.
Dr. Scranton.
If you've quite finished.
Colonel Smith.
Sorry, sir. Please continue.
Liaison, Air Force.
Well, we picked up something interesting from the NAT. They sent it up from McGuire AFB in New Jersey, not Wright-Patterson, and it hedge-hopped around Pennsylvania for an hour, and here are some of its holiday snaps.
Liaison, Central Intelligence Agency.
Holy sorry.
Colonel Smith.
Well, isn't that interesting?
Dr. Scranton.
The cat is out of the bag, gentlemen.
Liaison, Air Force, pointing.
That's a railroad switchyard. And here's some kind of industrial plant, A factory, we think, but this is preliminary. That definitely looks like an ore conveyor, though.
Colonel Smith.
Yes. So, we have heavy industry for sure, and we can infer the existence of air defenses, possibly even defenses that can take out an RQ-4.
Pause.
Has anyone briefed NCA yet? NSC? The Joint Chiefs?
Dr. Scranton.
There's worse to come.
Colonel Smith.
Oh dear.
Liaison, Air Force.
I hadn't got to the air samples yet.
They show a surprisingly low level of PM10 and PM50 particulates, which mostly come from diesel engines. This tends to suggest that they use all-electric traction on their railroads.
But then there's the radiation issue.
Colonel Smith. Radiation? What did you find, Lewis?
Liaison, Air Force.
I'd like to remind everyone that you can get some radioactive isotopes in your air just from burning too much coal. We're going to have to give the eggheads more time to chew it over, eliminate other possible causes. But we are seeing isotopes like cesium-133 and iodine-131, and the radioisotope mass yield curve suggests they come from prompt, not thermal, fission of plutonium-239 and a bunch of thermal neutron-induced fission of uranium-238.
Liaison, Central Intelligence Agency.
What does that mean?
Liaison, Air Force.
It's fallout from an atmospheric H-bomb detonation. The plutonium fission fragments came from the initiator and spark plug. The U-238 products come from the whole realm. They, or someone on their timeline, set off one or more thermonuclear devices quite recently. Less than a month ago, in fact. And it was probably in the 100 kiloton to 5 megaton range. This might indicate an active above-ground H-bomb test program, but the timing is right for them to have nuked our drones out of the sky.
Dr. Scranton. We're playing it close for now, gentlemen, but the White House is aware of the situation. A decision has been made, for better or worse.
Pause.
As of now, we're treating this timeline, Timeline 178, as a high-tech threat. It gets its own code name. Black Rain, a hat tip to the fallout. While a national security order has been drafted and SAC are migrating a paratime-capable B-52 bomb wing armed with nuclear-tipped cruise missiles to Thule, just in case, the president has made it abundantly clear that this is a defensive posture only, not preparation for a first strike. She's been briefed on Camp Singularity and is fully aware of the implications. She wants to play this very low-key, until we can provide some intel context on what we're dealing with in Black Rain. She doesn't want to risk whacking a hornet's nest with a baseball bat unless there's no alternative.
Colonel Smith.
This is what you were priming us for, isn't it?
Dr. Scranton.
Yes, Colonel. I'm afraid we've run out of time. We're going to keep probing with Tier 1 drones and micro-UAVs, but they can only get us so far. We badly need human eyes at ground level.
Liaison, Central Intelligence Agency.
But she's not ready to deploy yet.
Colonel Smith.
Leave that to me.
End transcript. Upstate New York, Timeline 2, July 2020. That afternoon, Rita flew into Rochester on a Delta connection via Minneapolis. She was as tired and irritated as usual on arrival. She'd been mildly disappointed to discover that her DHS staff ID card didn't give her the right to magically sidestep the airport security lines or the scrum at the checked baggage belt. All she wanted to do was rent a car and drive out to the transit facility for Camp Graceland. She was not expecting to find Colonel Smith waiting for her in arrivals, looking impatient.
Your flight is late.
Tell me about it, sir.
She'd worked out early on that calling him Sir put the Colonel in a more receptive frame of mind. "You aren't here just for me, are you?"
"As a matter of fact, I am. Walk this way. We need to talk."
Rita tried to keep up with him while wrestling with 3 months' worth of baggage. It was a futile battle, adding extra stress on top of her irritation and the layer of stifling paranoia added by the Colonel's arrival. "What does he want now?" she wondered. She knew she hadn't done well on the FBI course, but surely it would take something more important to drag the Colonel out of his office for the day. Smith headed straight for the drop-off lane in front of the terminal, then paused for her to catch up. A gray government car nosed into the curb beside him. The trunk and doors sprang open.
"Let me help you with that," he said,
taking Rita's suitcase to her chagrin.
"Get in. We've got a lot of ground to cover."
It wasn't exactly a luxury limo, but there was a privacy screen between the passengers and the driver up front. The Colonel climbed in beside her, fastened his seatbelt, then rapped on the partition.
"You're probably wondering if this is about the course," he told her as the car moved off. "It's not. What's happened is..."
He paused, then rummaged for a bottle of water in the storage bin the car featured in place of an armrest.
"Want one? No? Okay. There's been a major new development, and I'm rearranging your training and operational preparedness as a result."
"New development?" Rita echoed.
"We thought we had a year to put you through the standard clandestine ops backgrounder, but events are outrunning us. The original plan was to certificate you for basic field work, then assign you as a trainee analyst for a year or two before looking into provisioning you for autonomous paratime deployment. Unfortunately," he grimaced, "shit just got real, so we're rescheduling everything."
"What kind of shit? What rescheduling?" Smith opened his water bottle and chugged it.
"Sorry. You need to be able to world walk. This may be a false alarm, in which case it's back to training as usual, but we need you ready for deployment at short notice. You're going to be in the clinic for a month."
"Clinic? What clinic?" Rita realized her voice was shrill. "What does this involve?"
"No brain surgery."
Smith flashed her a nervous grin, evidently startled by her response.
"No knives, nothing like that. Just a couple of injections. Well, actually, there is some surgery involved. On your left arm, I'm assuming you're right-handed. It's an implant to control the ability. But my understanding is that it's pretty straightforward stuff. And once you're in control, you can take some leave or go straight back to studying Spook 201. It's just that it can take up to a month, and in a worst-case scenario, we may not have a month in which to activate you when we need you."
"Worst..." Rita stopped. "You're going to turn me into a world walker because you might need me at short notice?"
"Pretty much. Unfortunately, I can't tell you precisely why at this point. Let's just say we no longer have the luxury of giving you a lengthy training period. And for now, let's leave a big fat question mark over where and what it's all about."
"Oh, great." Rita tensed. Her head was beginning to ache. "Is this optional?" The Colonel's fey grin was equally tense.
"Not really, no."
"Okay, sir." She leaned back, closing her eyes. "Where are we going?"
"You don't need to know. Let's just say it's a private clinic in Connecticut within chopper range of a bunch of high-end hospitals for backup if we need specialized help. First, you'll undergo a couple of brain scans, MRI and PET, and a lumbar puncture. Then you sit around for a couple of days. Then there'll be some injections. Next, you go into a special isolation suite, which is locked down to prevent you triggering by accident. After a few days, they'll begin testing you with a particular trigger engram in a safe space. If you world walk successfully, you'll find yourself in a mirror installation in the destination timeline we're using for testing. Then after a couple of weeks of tests and training so you know how to work your new ability, They'll implant you with an emergency beacon, show you how to use it, and that's it. Oh, except for the legal formalities, which we'll run you through before we activate you.
Legal?
World walking is illegal without a court order issued by a Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court. They amended the law in 2004. So, before we switch you on, we have to haul you up in front of a judge, confirm you're a DHS employee, and get you a shiny personalized certificate, giving you carte blanche to commit a felony, as long as you do so on government business, that would normally carry up to 20 years in jail or an unlimited fine per occurrence.
Oh. Rita fell quiet for a minute. There's a lot here that I don't understand.
There's a lot here I don't want to ask you about, she added silently. Over the past few months, a claustrophobic cynicism had settled deep into her bones. Trust no one and verify everything, it prompted. She hated it, but...
Don't worry. I've got a classified background briefing document for you that goes into all the details in mind-numbing detail. You're cleared for it. Just remember it's code word secret, and not for public disclosure.
How routine is all this?
Rita opened her eyes.
You're the first, said Smith,
staring out the window at the passing traffic on the other side of the highway.
I'm a guinea pig?
She stared at him.
How many other clan orphans do you think we have?
I don't know. Hell.
Listen, we have been manipulating this stuff in cell cultures for nearly 2 decades now. We know all about how the process works. Most of the stuff you need to worldwalk is already inside you. We're just going to repair the broken on-off switch. Yes, it's an experimental process. But you're valuable to us. You're not the only one, but people like you don't grow on trees. Professor Schwartz isn't going to tell her team to do anything if she doesn't think it's safe to proceed. And on the other side of the coin, think what the benefits are. You're going to gain a superpower and get an opportunity to use it to protect America. Doesn't that mean something to you?
Sitting in the back of a government limo and listening to a highly persuasive secret police colonel, all Rita could do was nod, nervously. Whether because she agreed with him or because it was the course of least resistance, she herself could not have said.
They ask you to do one more unforgivable thing and you cannot back out, Kurt had explained.
At the time, she hadn't really understood. But now?
I can cope, she lied. Somewhere in Connecticut. Timeline 2. July 2020. The first week went exactly as Colonel Smith had told her it would, except for one significant deviation. He hadn't mentioned the boredom. The clinic was located in Woodland, somewhere off a highway between Durham and New Haven, and there was sporadic cell service at best, and none in her room, which was underground. There was no cable TV, no high-speed internet access, and if she wanted to update her phone or check her email, she had to go upstairs and hope for a signal. There was a small library of dog-eared books in the rec room, but it appeared to be policed by a member of the nursing staff who was both excessively friendly and claustrophobically evangelical. Consequently, its contents were not to Rita's taste. She was the only patient, although there were half a dozen beds. The clinic's main function, she gathered, was to perform surgery to change the biometrics of deep-cover DHS agents, bone shim insertions to change gait and facial appearance, fingerprint and iris transplants, even experimental CRISPR genome editing of epithelial cells to spoof DNA sequencers. Rita spent her time in the break room, trying not to attract attention. Short of going for long walks inside the perimeter fence, it was the best entertainment on offer, which was to say, very little.
Good morning.
Dr. Jennifer Lane greeted her brightly on her first morning.
Call me Jen. I work for Professor Schwartz, who runs the project here,
and I'm responsible for your therapeutic regime. If you have any questions about the medical aspects of this procedure, I'm the person you need to talk to."
Rita smiled, taking an instant dislike to the doctor, whose bright-eyed chirpiness reminded her of early morning lectures, suffered in silence after student drinking parties. Not her greatest moments, but nevertheless.
"I guess you want to know all about how world walking works for walkers of worlds. Isn't that the case?"
"Kill me now," Rita thought.
"Yeah, but can I grab a coffee first?"
She hadn't slept well, or at all, if she was perfectly truthful with herself. She'd spent the night wired up to a mobile EEG and an ambulatory blood pressure monitor, which by 4 a.m. had become an almost unendurable torture, for it woke her up with her arm in agony whenever it inflated, which was every half hour.
"I'm not myself right now." "Absolutely. Caffeine is safe at this point, so I'll just fetch one for you right now. How do you take it?"
"Flat white, extra shot, no sugar." Rita slumped into the patient's chair in the doctor's office as Jen bounded away in the direction of the coffee robot by the nurse's station. She yawned, scratched half-heartedly at the inflatable cuff around her arm, and tried not to doze off. The doctor returned regrettably rapidly, just as the blood pressure monitor ground its gears and the cuff began to inflate again, sending sparks of pain into her arm.
"So," Dr. Jen bounced into her chair, "world walking. Let's skip the physics for now. It goes off into brain theory, which nobody understands without a PhD in pure mathematics. Let's just say we live in a multiverse, a bundle of parallel universes branching off each other. The vast majority are identical but for some quantum uncertainty, and they keep merging and re-emerging. But there are sheaves of parallels where the differences add up to something we can tell apart. A huge number of such sheaves exist, and we call them timelines. The world-walking mechanism uses some intracellular machinery, self-replicating wet-phase nanotechnology with embedded quantum dots to ensure coherence of the wave function, that can bounce you and anything electrostatically earthed with you into another timeline, as long as the cue machines are all triggered together. The trigger event is a bunch of them going into the same state transition more or less simultaneously, and the easiest way to get this to happen is by hitting a bunch of neurons in your brain that contain cue machines with a signal that excites all of them at once. The easiest bunch to trigger are in your lateral occipital complex, where your vision system recognizes images. We hit them with a unique image, a complex knotwork. And as you recognize it, the cue machines in that part of your brain activate. You're probably wondering how we control which timeline you end up in. It's all in the knot we use. Different knots have different dimensional parameters, and so they trigger different recognition groups, and this causes differential ensemble excitation in the cue network.
Rita raised a hand.
"Whoa, this is too much."
She smiled defensively.
"I look at a knot, and it makes these cue machines send me to another universe."
Dr. Jen smiled back at her. Patronizingly or sympathetically, it was equally annoying.
"That's the gist of it. My, you're quick on the uptake this morning. Yes. But not all knots work in this way. Only ones that follow certain geometric rules. And of course they don't take you anywhere yet because your cue machines are inactive because of the missing link between your own central nervous system and the cue machines."
Rita's heart sank as she noticed Dr. Jen gearing up for more neurobabble.
"The world walkers all carry a gene for a non-standard postsynaptic glutamate receptor. It binds to the cue machines and activates them. However, whoever designed the mechanism used a hack to switch production of the modified receptor on, and it turns out to be a recessive trait. You've got the gene for the receptor, but it's not expressed, actually making receptor proteins, unless both your parents were world walkers, which in your case they were not.
Dr. Jen paused barely long enough to draw breath.
We can fix that now, thanks to a big-budget top-secret research project called Jaunt Blue. You've heard of the $6 million man or the $7 million woman? You're going to be the half-billion-dollar world walker. That's inflation for you.
How exactly does this work? Rita narrowed her eyes, annoyed by Dr. Lane's attempt at manipulating her through levity.
Genetic engineering? Stem cells? No. That would be impractical and potentially dangerous. Instead, we do some tests to make sure that your receptor complex is inactive because of the stalled repressor function, then infuse a short interfering RNA sequence into your cerebrospinal fluid that gives it a kick. The only dangerous aspect is that if you start world walking prematurely, if something triggers you, you can end up lost in paratime, which is why you're sleeping in an underground bedroom where the only place you can go is a corresponding underground mirror room on a base in Timeline 4.
What? You mean I can end up buried underground or something?
No. Dr. Jen shook her head emphatically. You can't world walk into a solid object, nor can you move while world walking. Actually, there's a lot about it that we don't understand yet. The Earth is moving through space, for example, so why do you move with it? What about the air in the timeline you're going to that you displace? We figure there are safety mechanisms we haven't decoded yet. But that's not my department. That's for the physicists to worry about.
Oh, Rita thought for a bit. So what happens is entirely controlled by my seeing some kind of, what did you call it? A trigger engram? A knot?
Yes. Whoever designed the world-walking cue machinery was pretty careful about that. They picked a set of topological deformations in the visual field that don't occur in nature. And believe me, this mechanism was designed. It certainly didn't evolve. It's very unbiologically straightforward. While they recycled the glutamate pathway and the recognizer networks from existing neural wetware, the self-replicating Q-dot machines have all but got patent numbers stenciled on them. They look a bit like mitochondria under an electron microscope, and they're self-replicating like mitochondria, but they're 100% engineered. And there are additional mechanisms to ensure they get copied and packed in the acrosome during meiosis. It's high-grade nanotechnology, miles ahead of anything we can match yet. Anyway, you're mostly safe from running into a trigger engram by accident. But you've flown recently? You saw the DHS notice when you signed on to the in-flight Wi-Fi? They only switch on the Wi-Fi above 10,000 feet once the plane is airborne, and the animated background to the DHS logo...
Rita swallowed. It's some kind of knotwork design. Is that a trigger engram?
Yes. The theory is that if the clan are sending world walkers here and they try to catch a commercial flight, the plane will land with one fewer passenger than it took off with, which will flag it for us. The flight data recorders log the flight's GPS coordinates when the Wi-Fi is switched on, so we know where to look for the world walker's body.
But I...
Relax. There are a couple of ways of turning off your sensitivity to triggers. The simplest method is to close your eyes. If you need to switch off for longer, there are drugs that mess with your glutamate pathways and render you unable to world walk for a period of hours to days. And we think there's a kind of meditation you can practice that will stop it from working on you, if you have time to put yourself in the right frame of mind.
Where did you get that from?
Jen's smile slipped. I can't tell you that.
DHS has captured world walkers, right?
Dr. Lane's smile turned cold. You are not supposed to ask that kind of question. If DHS has captured world walkers, it would be a very serious and highly classified project. Even asking about them without prior clearance would be a serious security infraction. Luckily for you, I don't know the answer to your question, so I'm going to assume that the answer is no, so your question is not actually a security infraction. But how about we agree that we didn't have this part of the conversation at all? It'll make life ever so much easier.
Okay. Rita surrendered unconditionally. Good cows avoid the electric fence. There's plenty of juicy grazing in the middle of the meadow without risking any nasty shocks.
Not that she was taking the doctor's denial as anything other than confirmation, but some fictions were best preserved.
What do you want me to do today?
That's better, Dr. Lane muttered, apparently unaware of her vocalization as she poked at her tablet. Then louder, she continued,
We've got a bunch more basics to go over this morning. Then this afternoon, we'll get you weighed, run a bunch of bloods, take your first baseline MRI, and start you fasting this evening. Tomorrow morning, we'll do the lumbar puncture. Then in the afternoon, we'll start the cognitive tests. And the day after tomorrow is your big day, starting with a visit from the judge who's going to swear you in and sign your court order, and then the second lumbar puncture.
Off-white walls, gray plastic floor, recessed overhead lighting, and no windows. A hospital bed with fancy-powered adjustable motors. A chirping bedside monitor with a fingertip clip to measure her blood oxygen levels, and a display showing her ECG trace, relayed wirelessly from the skin sensors taped to her torso. An IV drip. In a wardrobe in the corner of the windowless room, her suitcase and clothing, and personal effects. There was, Rita thought, an ancient symbolism embedded in the modern pattern. The liminal soul, suspended in the antechamber of death. First dynasty Egyptian princesses would have recognized her situation, but wondered at the absence of canopic jars. 18th century plantation heiresses might have questioned the lack of leeches and cupping. Not that Rita was doing too much thinking. The first day had tired her out, with a whiplash segue from Dr. Lane's high-velocity briefing into uncharted medical guinea pig territory. She'd given blood and urine samples, stool samples, weight and height, and then 3D morphological imaging measurements, and finally been subjected to a noisy, borderline claustrophobic hour in a full-body MRI machine. For dinner, they gave her clear soup and coffee with no milk. The second day started with a sedative and went rapidly downhill from there. On the third day, she'd awakened dizzy and lethargic, as if with a Valium hangover. They'd then put her in a wheelchair and brought her into an office. She'd haltingly echoed back an oath, with her hand on a book, to a hawk-faced man in a black gown. He asked her the questions Dr. Lane and Colonel Smith had told her to expect, then announced that he could see no reason not to issue the requested order. Then they stuck a cannula in the back of her left hand, and her day dissolved into confused kaleidoscope memories of being swallowed by brain scanners and attacked by electrodes. And on the fourth day, she awakened in this white and desolate space, wondering if it had all been a terrible mistake, and life was still waiting for her, somewhere outside. The implant in her left arm itched. Flinching slightly, Rita raised her right hand to scratch, then remembered she didn't have Haptotech's motion capture implants anymore. The base clinic at Camp Graceland had removed them on her first day, packaged them up, and returned them to her former employer. She rubbed the inside of her left elbow furiously, and the pain shifted to the back of her forearm. Referred pain. There was something there, embedded under the layer of fat beneath the skin.
something the size of a long grain of rice. An emergency beacon? A new implant? She wondered as she lifted her arm. There was a yellow-green bruise below her wrist, and a cotton ball held down with micropore tape across the injection site. The familiar itch had fooled her into thinking it was in the usual location, when it was just interfering with the same nerve. Implant. Fuck. She fumbled around until she could bring the bed's motor controller into her line of sight, then stabbed random buttons until, with a whir, the backrest began to rise. As she sat up, the vertigo began to subside. Now she felt a moment of nausea, but recognized it for what it was. Hunger, gnawing at her guts with the insistent ache of 2 days near starvation. With that realization, a bunch of other irritating imps began jabbing their metaphorical tridents into her. She had a headache, she felt dizzy, and she was hungry. Her muscles felt as if she'd fought a bout with the flu, and the flu won. Last but not least, she needed the toilet badly, and she had no idea where it was. There was a call button. Not feeling at all proud, she pushed it. A minute later, she heard a door open behind her bed.
"Oh, you're awake."
The nurse who bustled in green scrubs and gloves was the friendly but religious one, Marianne, who ran the library in the rec room.
"And how are we feeling this morning?"
Rita tried to smile.
"I need the bathroom, but I'm dizzy and..."
"Not to worry, we'll have you there in a second."
The bathroom turned out to be right behind her. It was a typical hospital unit with grab rails everywhere, and a smart toilet primed to snitch on her eating habits every time she pooped. Was everything in this clinic a potential informant? Rita wondered, as Marianne helped her out of bed and hovered until she had a solid grip on the rail. Quite possibly. After all, the health industry had been an enthusiastic and early adopter of the Internet of Things that leak personal information, right behind the NSA in the queue. Morning ablutions completed, Rita returned to her room, towing her IV stand behind her. Marianne had brought in an armchair and a bedside table while she was in the bathroom.
"What am I meant to be doing today?" Rita asked.
"Nothing," Marianne smiled. "Well, apart from eating 3 square meals and taking it easy, we've got a couple of tests for you. But you don't start the post-op workup until 72 hours after the activation shots. You may feel a bit feverish or unwell. That's expected with this treatment. But Dr. Lane will look in on you later this morning, and if you feel particularly bad, you can call at any time and one of us will come."
"Oh."
Rita digested this information.
"I've got a couple of days off?"
Marianne nodded.
"Can I go and sit outside? Or use the rec room?"
"Ah, well, there's a problem, you see."
Marianne smiled, presumably with disarming intent.
"You're not supposed to leave this suite. It's mirrored in another timeline for safety, in case you jaunt by accident or see a trigger symbol."
"Oh, is there a TV?"
The nurse shook her head.
"Internet?"
"I'm sorry," Marianne said brightly. "I can bring you some books if you like, but you're not allowed any visual media at all until Dr. Lane says so. No internet, no TV, not even magazines or newspapers."
"Books."
The prospect of spending the next 3 days cut off from the world did not fill Rita with unalloyed joy. Camping on a hiking trail in the wilderness was one thing. Climbing the walls in a soothingly featureless hospital room was something else again.
"Yes, please, if you don't mind."
"Sure," Marianne chirped. "I'll just go and let catering know you're ready for breakfast."
Breakfast was predictable. Cereal, juice, an anemic boiled egg, low-fiber toast.
Rita wolfed it down, then confronted the morning with a cup of weak coffee and growing boredom. Marianne returned, bringing a small pile of books and pamphlets with her. To Rita's dismay, they consisted entirely of testimonials for Scientology. Rita had nothing against religion as such. Kurt had grown up Lutheran. Mom and Dad had occasionally taken her to church and sent her off to summer camps run by them. But their approach to such matters was very much that it was a social club. Rita wasn't sure what she believed, beyond a vague sense that there was something up there keeping an eye on things. Consequently, she found Marianne's pamphlets disturbing in their zealous insistence that Dianetics and only Dianetics held the key to realizing one's full potential. Spending the day reading advertorials for someone else's scripture lacked appeal, so she unpacked and stowed her clothing in the wardrobe, just for something to do. That was when she discovered the musty coverless paperback that Grandpa Kurt must have stuffed down a zipped side compartment of her carry-on. Normally she had no time for elderly pulp novels, but at least it wasn't a religious tract. There was nothing lightweight about The Grasshopper Lies Heavy. The combination of the author's paranoid outlook and his cautionary tale within a tale, set in a metafiction in which the Nazis had won the Second World War, made her head spin as she tried to understand it. But the lack of any alternative kept her chewing doggedly along until evening. Whoever had owned it previously had underlined a couple of passages in every chapter in thick gray pencil, sometimes phrases or words, and sometimes individual letters. Trying to make sense of the annotations gave her a little more to chew on, but ultimately that too was unproductive. Unfortunately, it wasn't a particularly fat book, and she reached the end all too soon. The end pages were blank, and she was about to close the book when something caught her eye. As she turned past the end matter, she found herself confronted by a page covered in tiny, very precise handwriting. Squinting in the illumination of the adjustable bedside lamp, she read the opening. "Dear Rita, if you need to talk to me in private, write by hand, trusting no keyboard. Use this book as your one-time pad, using the two methods described below. High risk, low content fast, and low risk, high content slow. I may not be able to help, but if you don't ask, you don't get. Kurt." Inscribed in the middle of the page, before the code instructions that followed, was a pencil sketch of a knot. As Rita looked at it, it made her feel oddly queasy, guts twisting, vision blurring. She blinked it away hastily, then covered it with her thumb, heart hammering. "Oh, Gramps, what have you gotten us into?" She began to read the rest of Kurt's message. Boredom was suddenly very far away. Baltimore, Timeline 2, July 2020. Federal employee 00491-0023 classified voice transcript. Dr. Scranton. "Okay, so our pawn has just leveled up to queen. What's the state of play looking like now that our prototype is nearing deployment readiness?" Colonel Smith.
"Well, I think I've got a pretty good feel for her character, and she's not perfect. But things could be a lot worse."
Agent Gomez. "Oh, what's not?" Colonel Smith.
"For starters, we're not dealing with a classic authoritarian follower personality. Not even your typical Gen Z me-first narcissist with no patriotism and no loyalty. Instead, she got your full-on liberal, nurturing, question-authority upbringing with an added dose of extreme political cynicism from her grandfather. This doesn't mean she's useless. You can motivate anyone given the right lever. but she's going to take some work. She's actually a lot better suited to the mission profile we're looking at than someone who obeys orders blindly just because they feel good when Daddy tells them what to do. The key issue is that she's an introvert. Self-contained is a job requirement for spies, especially solitary infiltrators, but it means she doesn't open up easily and tell us what she's thinking, and that will make it hard to motivate her. And it means she doesn't do well in all facets of training.
Dr. Scranton, are we talking about her National Academy session?
Colonel Smith. Yes. I had to pull strings just to ensure she scraped a pass. I didn't rig it. I just made sure she got some TLC, extra coaching. Let's be honest. She's not a cop, much less an officer on the leadership inside track. She didn't belong on that course. She was a fish out of water. It's to her credit that she finished it at all, even with a bare pass. Putting a 25-year-old introspective liberal female actor through a graduate-level course in policing and leadership populated by ex-Army county sheriffs and upwardly mobile municipality lieutenants was a big risk. But she survived. She nearly wiped out, but it didn't break her. Which makes me think she's got what it takes to operate in an unsympathetic environment as well as having picked up the insight she needs for evasion planning. If we can earn her loyalty, we're gold.
Agent O'Neill.
That's the hard part.
Colonel Smith.
You know the old saying? Set a thief to catch a thief. We were trying a new angle. Train a spy in security policing to avoid getting caught by the adversary's secret police.
Dr. Scranton. Nevertheless, it seems to me that failure would have had a significant impact on her morale, not to mention making it harder to keep this little red wagon rolling along. Oversight wouldn't like it.
Colonel Smith. I'd have pretexted her out of there in an hour if I thought she was going to crack.
Agent Gomez. So now we have this introverted liberal hippie actress chick with diplomas in police leadership skills from the FBI, Espionage 101 training, and dragon's teeth capability? In what way does this get us closer to our objective?
Colonel Smith. We ran out of time. You're on the distribution. You got the memo about Black Rain.
Agent Gomez. Yes, but I don't see how...
Colonel Smith. She was set for another 6 months of clandestine ops school, then 2 years pushing a desk with operational analysis before deployment, under constant scrutiny, of course, and we were going to take the time to weld some handles onto her to make her easier to move around.
Dr. Scranton. What did you have in mind?
Colonel Smith. Boyfriend, girlfriend, whichever way she swings. Background says she dated boys in college but didn't have anyone serious. Meanwhile, there was a female BFF in high school, lots of tears when she moved away. So it's not entirely clear which way she leans. But it doesn't matter. If we can get her emotionally attached to someone, we have a handle. Or if we find something she's afraid of, we have a handle. Or if she gets religion, same deal. Or if we get her to imprint on her colleagues, the small unit paradigm, that works too. She may be an introvert, but she's not invulnerable. We just need to get her to open up.
Agent Gomez. We can use her without a handle if push comes to shove, can't we?
Colonel Smith. Yes. But it's less reliable. Humans are social organisms. We want her to feel protective toward us as a society before we send her out among them. Otherwise, there's the risk of Stockholm syndrome.
Dr. Scranton, we don't need that. Termination expedient is all very well as a policy, but not a sensible option for unique assets. Too much risk of making the wrong call.
Agent O'Neill. So you want her to fall in love, get religion, discover patriotism, discover team loyalty, or learn to fear us. Okay. So noted. But why has everything come so far forward?
Dr. Scranton. Because of Black Rain. We've lost 3 drones and detected fallout in that timeline. People in high places are beginning to ask questions, and it falls to us to provide answers.
Colonel Smith.
Once is happenstance, twice is coincidence, but 3 times is enemy action.
Dr. Scranton. Exactly. End transcript.